On this podcast, we discuss medical diagnoses and procedures. All of the guests express their own opinions. You should always seek medical advice from a trained and credentialed professional when making decisions about your own health. Welcome to the Sleep Apnea Stories podcast. I'm Emma Cooksey, and I've been coping with sleep apnea since childhood. I didn't know anyone in my life with a sleep disorder, so I decided to start this podcast. I'm here to build community and provide a platform for people with sleep apnea to tell their stories. Together, we can shatter stereotypes and raise awareness. We'll be exploring all sorts of treatment options and lifestyle choices to help you live your best life with sleep apnea. This is Sleep Apnea Stories, and I'm so glad you're here. Hey there, it's Emma Cooksey here, and I'm your host. So I'm super excited for today's guest, because when I first started my podcast, I had Dr. Stephen Park on my wish list for people I really wanted to interview for the podcast. So I'm really glad that we managed to make this happen. So before we get on to that, a couple of little updates for you. Quite a lot going on with Project Sleep. So if you listen a lot, you'll know that I'm on the board of directors for a nonprofit called Project Sleep. Coming up, we have our annual sleep-in, which is held on March 8th through 10th. For more information and to kind of sign up so that you get the emails about that, you can go to project-sleep.com. So one of the things I'm doing as part of that is I'll be interviewing Heather, who runs Project Sleep's sleep helpline that we just launched. So I'm going to be interviewing her on the Project Sleep Facebook page on Friday, March 8th. So that'll be a chance to see me interviewing someone live, and I'm kind of excited about it. A bit nervous, because I like the safety of editing, but I think it'll be really good. So there's that, and then there's also, this Thursday, there's another event which I'm taking part in, where I'm on a patient panel, and we're going to be aiming that event at journalists. Anyone's welcome to tune in, but specifically if you know any journalists or writers who have a particular interest in sleep, this is a really great event for them. We have a toolkit that they can access, which will really help them to write about sleep disorders in a better way than's happening right now. So I think oftentimes you see these sleep stories, and it's all to do with how to get the right pillow or sleep hygiene tips, which are great, but there's no mention of that people might have a sleep disorder that they need to get help with. So we're just trying to change that with what we're doing. So if you're interested in that, go to project-sleep.com, and there's a link right there on their homepage. So on to today's guest. Today I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Park. He's a board-certified ENT surgeon as well as a sleep doctor with a passion for helping you breathe better so you can sleep better and live life to the fullest. He's the author of the Amazon best-selling book, Sleep Interrupted: A Physician Reveals the Number One Reason Why So Many of Us Are Sick and Tired. It was endorsed by many New York Times best-selling authors, including doctors Christiane Northrup, Dean Omish, and Mark Lipinus. His YouTube videos have been viewed over 4 million times. He received his bachelor's degree from the Johns Hopkins University and his medical degree from the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University. And he's also the host of a podcast called Breathe Better, Sleep Better, Live Better. And so we talk in the episode about how he stopped that podcast, but there's a bunch of back episodes you can listen to. So I hope that we're going to coax him back to podcasting, because he just has such great information in those podcasts. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Stephen Park. So Dr. Park, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
I'm really, really delighted because I'm a big fan. So I've already read your books and listened to your podcast and all the things, but for anybody listening who hasn't heard about your work or doesn't know what you do, can you maybe just give us a bit of an a sort of background?
Well, I'm an ENT surgeon, also board certified in sleep medicine. And I started off as a general ENT in private practice in Manhattan for about, I guess, about 13 years. And during my ENT practice years, I discovered that most of the people who came in for general ENT problems, like sinus, ear problems, throat problems, nose problems, they all had sleep problems. And on top of the sleep problems, they had acid reflux, and acid reflux can also lead to sinus problems. And then I found out that sleep apnea and acid reflux are related.
Yeah.
Acid reflux and sleep apnea. And it's like everything's all connected. Mm-hmm. And that's why I ended up writing my book called Sleep Interrupted, I guess about 12 or 13 years ago. And now I present my sleep breathing paradigm, how everything is all connected. And then it was just a journey for myself and my wife. Both of us have sleep problems. My wife has a long list of chronic health issues. I mean, it's much better now because of what we've done.
Yeah.
So this is a personal journey as well as something that I found that's really helpful for my patients as well.
Yeah. I know that you talked a little bit in the Sleep Interrupted book about your wife being pregnant and mm-hmm. you noticing some of those issues with her. So did you want to tell us a little bit more about your own experience with sleep disordered breathing?
Sure. So when I was younger in school, I always fell asleep during classes, even in medical school. So luckily I went.
I would have thought especially in medical school because
yeah,
it's so many hours.
Right. But luckily I went into a field where I had to run around all the time. I'm on my feet as a surgeon. And so luckily I went to a profession where I'm constantly, you know, walking and interacting with people. If I had a desk job, I'd be miserable.
Yeah.
But it's funny, for example, in New York City, I saw a lot of police officers and firemen who, when they're young, they're very energetic, very enthusiastic, and they're very good at what they do. But once they get very good at what they do with their jobs, they get promoted to a desk job, and then everything goes downhill.
Oh, that's super interesting.
Because they start to gain weight, and then they start to have all the sleep breathing problems. So I see this pattern happening over and over again. And going back to my wife, I wrote in my book that after her first pregnancy, she gained about 50 pounds. And she was miserable during the pregnancy. And then afterwards, she was even more miserable because she couldn't lose that weight. She had severe postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really rough year for us. And then eventually she got better. And then for her second pregnancy, she didn't gain that much weight. But then after delivering, she was very dizzy, lightheaded, extremely tired, just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized, I wrote this in my book, we realized that she only got better after her first pregnancy, after losing all the weight. And around that time, I had also diagnosed her father with sleep apnea. And she looks like her father.
Like and facially, her bone structure.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
And so everything kind of came together, and that's what gave me the idea to the inspiration to write my book. I got this, you can see this light bulb shining up in my head. And so, you know, it's funny, I had all these revelations throughout my life and my journey with my wife. But it's funny that the more you look into this, the more you see how everything's all connected. It's not just about breathing and sleep. It's about total health.
Yes.
Mental, mental illnesses, psychiatric problems, hormonal imbalances, all stages of life. It's been a blessing for me to be able to be privileged to this information, to go beyond the boundaries of Western medicine.
Yeah.
And to be able to just incorporate this, not only for my health and my family's health, but also to be able to share this information with everyone else.
I got my diagnosis with sleep apnea 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been to many a sleep specialist. And I feel like right now, the intake or your initial talk with a sleep specialist, they're not looking in your nose. They're not talking about your nose. They're not asking how you're breathing. Like, they might look in your throat at your tonsils, but
mm-hmm.
can you, for people that aren't really familiar, could you explain what does your nose have to do with sleep apnea in the first place, and why is it bad that we're overlooking it so much?
Yeah. Well, let me just go over one misconception about nasal breathing and sleep apnea. So unfortunately, if you address your nasal congestion, and people think that snoring comes from the nose, so they address the nose first, and a lot of people are very disappointed.
Right.
And so, yes, it's important to breathe through your nose, but for other reasons, I'm going to get into a little bit later. What they've shown is that if you do nasal surgery, for example, which is a very aggressive form of treatment for the nose, for nasal congestion, it doesn't really cure sleep apnea. the results are pretty disappointing. Maybe 10% of people with very mild sleep apnea, they do get better, but overall, in general, it doesn't help. However, for the other sleep apnea treatments to work, such as CPAP or mouth guards, you have to breathe well through your nose. And even if you don't have sleep apnea, it's really, really important to breathe through your nose, because your nose makes a gas called nitric oxide. And this gas, when inhaled into your lungs, it increases oxygen uptake by 10 to 20%. Plus, nitric oxide kills bacteria, viruses, and funguses. So if you breathe through your mouth all the time, you're gonna have problems in your nose, your sinuses, and your lungs too. So going back to the breathing issues for the CPAP treatment, there's, for example, what really opened my eyes to this is that there was a study many years ago showing that people who couldn't tolerate CPAP, who also had nasal congestion, they used the CPAP maybe 30 minutes on average, but after nasal surgery, it went up to 5.5 hours. And that just opened my eyes. So that's why I'm relatively aggressive medically and surgically to offer nasal surgery. Do everything you can to improve well through your nose. But then I got the best results when I was able to do nasal surgery. But it's not just septum and turbinates, but we can talk about this a little bit more. But I also address the nostrils. Now, the reason why people have deviated septums, it's not from nasal trauma. It's from facial underdevelopment. So
yes.
And I talk about this in my book, where modern humans' faces are shrinking. And that's why everyone needs their wisdom teeth taken out now. And almost everyone needs braces now, right? All the kids. Now, 100 years ago, people didn't need braces. They still had all their wisdom teeth. So something is happening to our faces that's causing it to shrink.
Yes.
And that we could talk another hour about that.
We could talk for several hours. So I think that kind of leads me on a little bit to, I hear from so many patients at different stages in this, right? Who, I don't really hear from people who go to their doctor, get put on CPAP, and are doing just fine. I hear from people who are trying to address like underlying root causes of this and see sort of longer term solutions that are going to help improve their breathing at night, but also their health, right? Yes. So one of the things I hear a lot from people is about this having underdeveloped jaws and high narrow arch palates. Mm-hmm. And they're interested in looking at whether palate expansion, whether that's like a surgically assisted palate expansion, or now I know it's super controversial, but like there's certain companies looking at removable appliances for that. But should I do, if I'm thinking about some sort of palate expansion surgery, should I do that first to see if that will gain some space in the floor of the nose, or should they do nasal surgery first? I know it probably entirely depends on the person. Yeah. But that's a lot of the things that I get asked a lot that I'm kind of like, I must have an ENT surgeon on to talk more about that.
Well, I've actually interacted with tons of patients and also providers that do the whole range of these palatal expanders. And honestly, there's no easy answer. I don't think I can ever recommend doing one over the other. I would say do what you feel most comfortable doing, what's easiest, the lowest hanging fruit first.
Yeah.
What's most accessible. In the ideal world, you should try to do everything.
Right?
Because you want to breathe through your nose, you want a wider palate. And so don't think of it as either or, think of it as both.
Right. I think that kind of goes for all of sleep apnea treatment. Yeah. So for people who have maybe done that surgery, but still are dealing with, you know, some nasal issues where stuffiness and that kind of thing, which is maybe not a clinical thing, but it's just still annoying and means that they can't do well with CPAP. Is there a particular daily routine, or do you recommend breath work? Do you recommend, you know, using saline or something to clear out the nose and the sinuses?
Yeah, I have a lot to say about that. So this is before you consider surgery.
Right.
So the first thing is obviously allergies are a major factor. A lot of people have allergies, and there's a whole list of things you can do to prevent allergies. For example, I'm sure you've heard about this, getting a HEPA filter for your bedroom, getting rid of rugs or carpeting, addressing the pet issue if you're allergic to pets.
I know. How do you address the pet issue? That's a nightmare.
Well, that's why we ended up getting a hyperallergenic dog from the beginning.
Yeah.
But the problem is that you know, we have all these options that people hear about and you implement, but it works to various degrees. So yes, you have to go down the list, go down the checklist and do whatever you can, and that will help a certain number of people, but not everybody.
Yes.
So then you can also try the nasal saline irrigation, but obviously if you add on all these things, it just takes up more time, it's aggravating.
Yeah.
You're not gonna be able to do it all the time. So now one thing that has helped a lot of my patients, and this is the most important tip I give to anyone I see, even my friends and family, is don't eat within 3 to 4 hours of bedtime.
Oh.
And there's multiple reasons why that works. Number one, even if you have sleep apnea, for example, when you stop breathing just once or twice at night, it comes up, the reflux, the juices in your stomach come up into your throat because it forces it to get sucked up into your throat.
Yes.
So that causes inflammation in your throat. And what they've shown is that the juices that come up can then go into your nose, sinuses, ears, and your lungs, causing minor inflammation.
Mm.
Okay. So it doesn't happen all the time, but people say that when they stop eating late, not only do they sleep better, but the nasal congestion gets a little better too.
Okay. That's a really good top
now,
tip.
The other thing is that if you have any kind of nasal congestion, or let's say that you use breathe right trips or nasal saline so you can breathe better through your nose. But what happens is a lot of people, what they do is they open the mouth at night.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into this topic of mouth taping. I'm sure you heard of that.
Let's do it.
So,
which I think a lot of people think super controversial, but like I don't really think it's that controversial. So let's have your take on it.
Yeah. You know, the general medical profession, especially ENTs, are against it. But they have no basis on which they give their opinions because millions of people are using mouth taping with full benefit. And as far as I know, there have been no complications as a result. Because worst case scenario, you stop breathing and you wait, take it off and you wake up.
Right.
But when you have an apnea, you stop breathing and you wake up anyway. So it's the same thing, right?
Right.
But in theory, by taping your lips, you're going to have less apneas. And the reason is that when you open your mouth, the tongue gets pushed back. So you stop breathing more often.
Yes.
And when I was doing sleep endoscopy, where we take a look at the airway when you're sleeping, it's pretty dramatic. When you open the mouth even a little bit, the tongue goes back and obstructs your breathing.
Yes.
That's why it's so important to keep your mouth closed. But if you can't breathe through your nose, then you can't keep your mouth closed, right?
Right.
And one little caveat about the taping is that most of the stuff that comes out is to tape your lips together. And I think there's a couple of commercial brands out there. But if you just tape your lips together, you can still open your jaws.
Right.
And that's what causes the tongue to fall back. So what I do personally is just to take that 1-inch white medical tape from the drugstore, just go vertically down the middle, mm-hmm. and go under the chin to give it a little bit more support.
So your jaw isn't dropping down and your lips aren't opening.
Right. And you can breathe at the corners of your mouth if you have to.
Yeah.
Now, in the older way of doing this is to use a chin strap.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't work as well because usually the chin straps are elastic. In the old days, I used to recommend wearing a bandana.
Wow. Yeah, I think a little bit of mouth tape does sound more appealing. Some of the mouth tape thing where it gets super controversial is people talking about symptoms of what sound like sleep apnea mm-hmm. and saying, just tape your mouth. Whereas to me, like, go and get that tested for the doctors.
Yeah.
But then when people have CPAP as well, you really want to keep your mouth closed. Like, especially if you have a nasal pillows mask or a nasal mm-hmm. mask, mm-hmm. like that really affects whether the pressure is actually keeping your airway open or whether it's just going straight out your mouth.
Yeah, so that's why the chin straps can help people with CPAP because it keeps your jaw closed.
Another thing I kind of wanted to get into was just this whole idea of sleep apnea diagnosis. I hear from so many people who will go and have a sleep study and the doctor says your AHI was too low for a diagnosis of sleep apnea, mm-hmm. too low for treatment with CPAP, mm-hmm. and essentially like nothing to see here, mm-hmm. even though the person has significant symptoms in their life and also events, like they're having a bunch of events, but they're not meeting the criteria for sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. I want to know like where you would like to see this whole idea of diagnosing sleep apnea going? Should we be looking much more at the spectrum of sleep disordered breathing and preventing some of this? Or do we want to be looking at, I don't know, hypoxic burden and RDI and different metrics?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the area that I have the most amount of interest in. And that's what essentially my book is about. Yes, I talk about sleep apnea, but what I talk about more is something called upper airway resistance syndrome.
Yes.
And I found out about this condition from Dr. Gimeno, Dr. Christian Gimeno. He's one of the founding fathers of sleep medicine at Stanford. He passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But he just opened my eyes to the situation where, so he published a study in 1993, I think, young men and women, thin, healthy looking.
Yes.
Who were chronically tired, couldn't sleep, but they didn't have sleep apnea on a sleep test. Now, let me just go back a little bit with the definition of sleep apnea. Apnea means you stop breathing for 10 seconds or longer completely. Hypopneas are partial obstructive breathing, and there's different definitions, 30%, 40% with oxygen level dropping, but basically it has to be for 10 seconds or longer as well. So the apneas plus hypopneas per hour is your apnea-hypopnea index. Now, officially, to have a diagnosis of mild sleep apnea, you need 5 or more to say you have sleep apnea. But let's say that someone like me or a younger person stops breathing 25 to 30 times an hour for 9 seconds each.
Right.
Then your score is going to be 0. Now, you're not going to have lack of oxygen, but you have you stop breathing 25 times an hour.
Yeah.
And that's going to cause, it's going to wreak havoc on your sleep quality and your quality of life. So these people don't have the classic sleep apnea symptoms, for example. They don't fall asleep during the day. They don't have heart disease, diabetes. They're not overweight. But these people tend to have just chronic fatigue, headaches, sinus problems, migraines, digestive issues, anxiety, depression, cold hands, cold feet, low blood pressure. This is what my wife had after her second pregnancy.
Yeah.
And I have some of this too. And so this is a major problem. I think it's bigger than sleep apnea, honestly. And sleep apnea is pretty big in this country.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, like you alluded to, the system is set up to kind of, I don't know if they're intentionally ignoring it, but honestly, even if they listen to our concerns and lower the threshold to give people more diagnosis of upper airway resistance syndrome, or even just lower the threshold for sleep apnea, the system can't handle it. Because a sleep study takes weeks or months to get sometimes, and depending on where you live, the system can't handle the burden of all the additional patients coming in. But even then, the quality of the treatment, even for example, CPAP, as you alluded to, it's not that good because you don't get to spend too much time with the doctor or the technician.
Right.
The follow-up is relative. I mean, there, like you said, there are some, you know, positive situations, but for the most part, as a system, it's really, really bad.
Yeah.
And basically, the system is designed to fail. Now, fortunately, because of the internet, all these great websites like what you're doing, also all these other CPAP support groups, it's much better. It's much easier.
Yeah.
But people who depend on the traditional healthcare system, they're not going to, most of the time, they're not going to work.
Are you a new or struggling CPAP user? Are you waking up and flinging your CPAP mask across the room in frustration? Maybe you have mask leaks, skin irritation, or wake up with a dry mouth. You might be dealing with uncomfortable trapped gas from swallowing air or hair breakage from your headgear. If any of this sounds familiar, you're not alone, and I wrote a workbook just for you. The 6-week CPAP Solutions workbook is out now and has been designed to give you solutions to all the most common CPAP problems. Visit sleepapneastories.com to order now. That's sleepapneastories.com. So do you think like involving dentists is part of that? Like having them involved with screening and...
You know, dentists are definitely a couple of steps ahead of the medical doctors as a profession. Mm-hmm. Even since I wrote the book, they've come a long way in terms of awareness, and many more dentists are kind of jumping on the bandwagon to address these breathing problems. However, even with a dentist, just like the CPAP situation, it's a device, you need good follow-up.
Yes.
And not every dentist is very good at what they do. So ultimately, it's not so much the device itself, but the quality of the practitioner and the experience.
Sometimes the experience of the practitioner can really make all the difference, I think.
I could actually argue that an experienced dentist can take a very low-tech device and do a better job than an inexperienced dentist using a very high-tech device.
Right.
Or the latest and the greatest device.
Yeah, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we need to be looking more at kids with starting right at mouth breathing and trying to do some myofunctional therapy earlier, or how do you see that going?
Well, let's back up even beyond delivery. I would say you start the whole process when you're pregnant. They've shown that how well the pregnancy goes determines how well the baby comes out with a fully developed face.
It's so amazing.
Prematurity is actually a risk factor for sleep apnea.
Wow. Okay.
But they've actually shown that even 1 or 2 weeks term makes a difference in terms of the overall health of the child.
Yeah.
You want the child to have as healthy a pregnancy as possible. And so the basic concepts are obviously a healthy diet, minimize stress, which in this day and age, that's hard to do.
Yeah.
But I think the diet and the sleep, and a lot of women, for example, I think my wife, during her first pregnancy, she probably had sleep apnea during the pregnancy. And this is not picked up by the OBGYNs.
So I speak as somebody who had one pregnancy with undiagnosed sleep apnea and all the symptoms. And I've been going to the doctor for 10 years telling them, you know. And then my second pregnancy, it still wasn't perfect, but I had a diagnosis and I was on CPAP. So I think that it does make a big difference just, you know, knowing ahead of a pregnancy, like what you're dealing with.
But also, I was being referred to a lot of pregnant women in my previous hospital. And the system is somewhat clunky. It takes a long time to get the appointment. And by the time you treat them, sometimes by the time the CPAP arrives, they've delivered already. Or they've had major complications during the hospital.
To even get the sleep tests and things, you really have to advocate for yourself, right? And so women who have kind of gone and proactively said, I'm having these symptoms, this is how I'm feeling. One woman particularly I spoke to recently, they essentially told her what you just said. Like, it would take too long. You know, we're not going to have you do a sleep study when you're so close to the end of your pregnancy anyway, we'll just wait till after the delivery, you know, which when you think about that, what we're talking about is lack of oxygen to your brain and you're growing a baby.
Yeah.
It's really urgent.
Well, taking that to the next level, for example, a very common complication that we saw in the hospital setting is something called preeclampsia.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the Bronx where I used to work, it was very common, especially with obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a discussion with the OBGYNs. Sleep apnea, you can treat, I basically allude to the fact that preeclampsia, there's an association with sleep apnea. And there's lots of studies from, I think, Australia about 20, 30 years ago. But it never got put into practice. And they've shown that these preeclamptic women on CPAP, the fetal heart rate increased. Now, they didn't do other kinds of outcomes, but all the measures show that it did improve the quality of the pregnancy.
Mm.
And so when I mentioned that to them, they say, well, preeclampsia is an endothelial dysfunction issue, which is a very technical term, meaning that there's some problem with the vessels, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what they don't realize is that sleep apnea causes endothelial dysfunction. And when you treat people with CPAP, the endothelial dysfunction goes away.
So is there no, so we're not currently screening those women for sleep apnea?
No, never. I think it should be universal.
Yeah, I do too.
But the other problem is that a lot of pregnant women, even though they may have symptoms of sleep apnea, they're not going to have official sleep apnea like what you're talking about.
Right.
They're going to have upper airway resistance syndrome.
Yes.
And they have what's called flow limitation, where the breath gets kind of diminished. So it causes micro arousals in your brain. And so it's very fragmented sleep, especially in the third trimester.
Do you think that the more that we're seeing improvements with home testing, we might get to a point where we can pick up some of these lower, smaller flow limitations you're talking about, do you think, or how far away from that?
Well, I think that's a mixed bag. I think it's great that we have more home testing available, mm-hmm. and that will pick up more sleep apnea, the traditional sleep apnea. But they use the same scoring criteria as in-lab sleep studies for sleep apnea.
Yes.
And also this home test in general, not all, but in general, they're not as sensitive for the lower mild sleep apnea.
I feel like the just purely anecdotally from all the people I talk to, I feel like sort of older, overweight men with very high AHIs do great with home tests. And they say, yeah, you've definitely got sleep apnea. The thing I do worry about is sometimes there's people with significant symptoms who maybe don't have as high of an AHI, and the home test is, you know, negative for sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of those people, rather than asking more questions about their symptoms and doing more testing, they're kind of just told, you don't have sleep apnea.
In these situations, what I've suggested to some women is just use a mouth guard.
Yes. I'm thinking particularly about one of my friends that lives close to me here. She's been through doing the sleep apnea testing. They told her no, even though she had a lot of arousals, they were like, you don't have enough actual apneas or hypopneas to get a diagnosis and a CPAP. Mm-hmm. And so that was what she did. She went to a dentist she already knew and got a mandibular advancement device and now is sleeping better. So I think it is one of these things where I always think we need a million more diagnostic tests, but then in some ways with sleep apnea, you just need a treatment option that works for you, right?
Right. I think a lot of the conservative steps, for example, not eating late, nasal breathing optimization, sleep hygiene issues, all that's very important. That will address 10-15%, but as you go up the ladder, you need some kind of more definite intervention, right?
People in a sort of more severe state where they're doing CPAP or whatever, they can still benefit from the losing weight from all these things that you're talking about to hopefully make things better, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you have to sleep better to lose weight if you are overweight, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the one little caveat, which is a little bit disturbing, is that, and they've done pretty good studies on this and the huge meta-analyses and systematic reviews, that about maybe 5-10% of people on CPAP gain weight.
Yes. Yeah, I hear that from people who are saying, wait, my doctor said perhaps I'll lose weight because I'll be sleeping better. Do we know why that is?
I've read through all these papers and there's no real satisfying explanation. My feeling is that just like that, any other intervention, even though the CPAP may be treating the severe apneas, is causing more microarousals because something is on your face.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also just from people who still have some residual daytime sleepiness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their doctor's scratching their head because they're looking at their perfect compliance and that their AHI looks really low, but that's not the same as sleep quality.
Right.
Yeah.
And that you're absolutely right. I'm not accusing this of all sleep doctors, but as an industry in general, they go by the numbers, right?
Yes.
And if your AHI goes from 35 to 2, you should be sleeping much better.
Right.
But the chances of that happening is very low. I would say less than 20%.
You think so? That's so depressing.
Yeah. And the reason is that, first of all, if you're not going to use it, it's not going to work, right?
Right.
Actually, there's a story that I have. Dr. Carl Stepnowski, he's a very famous CDC medicine researcher. Mm-hmm. And he tells me that if 100 people are given CPAP machines for sleep apnea, 20% will reject it from the beginning. So now you're left with 80 people, right? Of those 80, when they start using CPAP, in 1 year, only 40 are using it.
Yes.
And of the 40, only 20 are using it properly.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they think that they're using it, but then they have like a really high leak rate and
they're taken
off halfway through and all of that.
Right.
So we're just not diagnosing enough people. And then we're also, because of the way the treatment is, a lot of those people are not ending up well treated at the end of it.
And you also mentioned before that you can have a perfect score on the CPAP machine and still feel terrible.
Do you think we just need a lot more research? I don't mean to sound really cynical, but one of the things I see is that there's a lot of motivation and funding available for studies showing the effectiveness of CPAP. And I just haven't seen a lot of studies where they're really looking into that, like why that is.
I haven't seen any, you're right, there aren't too many studies looking at that. A lot of theories and conjecture about it.
Yeah.
But my personal bias about this is that the CPAP itself, it's basically an airway pump, right? It's an airway stent, so it keeps everything open. But you have to assume that the pathway is open.
Right.
But let me just mention two interesting things that I found when I was in practice. There's something called epiglottic laryngomalacia. So not everyone's going to have this, but maybe about 5-10% of people will have it. Where
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. So the epiglottis is the cartilaginous hood on top of your voice box.
Mm-hmm.
And this can flap in when you breathe in. And this happens more often when you're newborn, a young child will have this. And it's pretty obvious when you see it because they go
right.
like this when they're awake, when they're crying. But what I'm seeing is that I see a lot of adults with this too.
Mm.
Because traditionally the ENTs are taught that people outgrow it as they get older. But I saw severe cases of epiglottic laryngomalacia in young adults as well, especially in kids too. And so when you can, unfortunately, the only way to treat that is surgery. And people don't want to go there oftentimes, but the ones that do get treated, they get some amazing results.
Good to know.
And the only way to know this is going on is to do what's called sleep endoscopy or drug-induced sleep endoscopy. And I don't think enough doctors utilize this test. They think put a camera up down your nose or throat when you're awake, that's enough. But
right.
you have to be sleeping to see what's going on.
Yeah. So can you explain really briefly? I always assume a lot of knowledge, but anybody listening who hasn't heard of a DICE procedure, can you explain a little bit about what
do? Sure. So this is, it's kind of like a colonoscopy, the same kind of sedation, propofol or some kind of other agent. And basically they have you fall asleep in the operating suite. And we just put a camera through your nose into your throat, like what happens in the office with an ENT.
Yeah.
It takes about 5-10 minutes.
So it kind of reproduces what your airway, like your throat, is doing while you're asleep. So you can see.
Right. And obviously it's artificial sleep, but they've shown that for the most part, it's a pretty good accurate measure of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how often are you doing that for people? Like if somebody comes to you with sleep apnea, would you do that as a matter of course to try and decide what to do?
For almost routinely for everyone who goes to the operating room, I'll start with the sleep endoscopy. And the reason is that they may do well with the CPAP, but if you're in that 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% chance that you're not going to tolerate CPAP,
right.
I want to know what's happening. I don't want to have to take you back into it again.
So here's the thing. A lot of people are going to a sleep specialist. They go to their doctor.
Mm-hmm.
They have all of these symptoms. They get referred to a sleep specialist. They go have a sleep study and find themselves back in the sleep specialist's office, probably starting CPAP. How often should people go and see the ENT? Should everybody go with the diagnosis of sleep apnea just to see what's happening? Or do they need specific issues? Why would they then go and see an ENT?
Okay. Well, obviously, a significant number of people will benefit from the CPAP. There are a certain number of people that do benefit from the start, especially, like you said, the severe sleep apnea patients.
Yes.
The people with the mild to moderate sleep apnea, those are the ones that have more problems. So, for example, if your nose is
stuffy,
which
seems counterintuitive, right?
Yeah.
But it's absolutely the way around it is. Like, I've interviewed some people with such high HIs, but not really that many symptoms. They're just kind of like, I went because my wife told me to.
Yeah.
And then I went on CPAP and I love it and it's great. And, you know, but I was fine before.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's the people with the very low AHIs, but who are constantly being woken up and just feel terrible. So it's really interesting that it's that way around. But.
Right. Well, what you see is that if you look at the sleep studies, they may have only a few apneas to give them the mild sleep apnea, but you see lots of microarousals.
Yes.
And so you see a lot more sleep fragmentation as opposed to the classic sleep apnea patients.
So we talked earlier about the importance of nasal breathing. So anyone who can't breathe well through their nose, should those people just go and see an ENT?
Exactly. Most sleep doctors would know to do this. Yeah. If they can't breathe through their nose, send them to an ENT. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that an ENT, most ENT practices also practice sleep medicine, or they'll treat for sleep apnea, even if they're not sleep medicine doctors.
Yes.
So depending on what pathway you end up going to, you can go to a dentist first, you can go to a sleep doctor first, or ENT.
Yeah. I think that I want is somebody to tell me, this is a flow chart. You start here and then you go down in this order. But I think that I've realized people are all so different and there's such a broad variety in symptoms and what challenges people have, how well they do with different treatments,
right,
that there really isn't one. Is that your experience? Just that
absolutely.
Really,
that's a really good observation. And I have similar findings to that in this regard as well, because it's not, every individual is very different in terms of what you're going to like, what you're going to respond to, but also your relationships with your providers, your doctors, where you live, what's available, what's not available. And CPAP probably is the most available, but more and more dentists are doing these mandibular advancement devices now.
Yeah.
And then ENTs. So basically now, ideally, in theory, there should be one interdisciplinary team. There are interdisciplinary centers, but not really truly integrated.
Right.
Ideally, it should be under one roof, not individual providers in the same space.
Right.
Because there's still that financial aspect also, unfortunately, with medicine.
Yes.
You have that aspect.
Tell everybody about the podcast that you did. Are they finished now?
We stopped doing that because I was doing that. Initially, I was doing what's called expert interviews. So interviewing people like you or other people in various different fields. And then I started doing it with my wife.
Yeah. I listened to them all. I was sad that they finished.
Yeah. We're thinking about on and off about starting it up again, but we have busy lives now. And I have some other bigger projects. I'm especially writing another follow-up book now. And so
terrific.
Different projects. But one thing I'm focusing on now is not just to do more sleep apnea or EYRS, is I've kind of expanded my horizons to include not just sleep apnea and breathing, and obviously that's important, but to include nutrition, habits, circadian rhythms, stress reduction, exercise, the whole shebang.
Oh,
just
great.
The problem is that just treating the sleep apnea, it's not satisfying.
I know, and you just can't get away from, because trust me, I've been trying, but you just can't get away from the fact that nutrition is a huge part of this.
Yes.
Is there anything else you can share?
Well, let me just kind of give you the 3 to 5 simple tips to get started with. So number 1, no eating close to bedtime.
Yeah.
Number 2, optimize nasal breathing. We talked about that. But you can start with using breathe right strips right away, right?
Yeah.
And that'll help. And using nasal saline, whatever you can do to open up your nose. If you have to use allergy medicines for a short period, that's fine too.
Yeah.
Then number 3, no electronic screens before bedtime. That's a big one for everyone these days, even for myself. And the reason is, 2 reasons. Number 1, and people may know this already, that blue light in these new screens lowers your melatonin sleep hormone.
Yes.
And so now melatonin starts to go up around 2 hours before your natural sleep time. So if you go to bed at 10, it's going to start to go up at 8. But that's when people start to watch TV or use the screens.
Yes. Right?
So it delays your sleep onset time. But one thing that people may not know about is that melatonin, the hormone, also lowers stomach acid production, insulin levels.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and also tightens the lower esophageal sphincter.
People are dealing with this problem that you were talking about of the stomach acid getting sucked up, then that might help.
Right. So it makes, if you eat late and you screens, acid reflux and bad, it's going to be much worse. And then the other, on the flip side, in the morning, first thing in the morning, you want to shine as much sunlight into your eyes as possible. So that resets your circadian rhythm.
Yes.
And also, now this is one other area that's really, really big, which people talk about sometimes, but they don't give enough importance, is how sunlight gives you vitamin D. And most people in America are very vitamin D deficient. It's shockingly low on average. And especially with COVID, it got much worse.
Mm-hmm.
So now, because of the scare about skin cancer, people are very overly cautious about skin cancer. But The studies I've read is that, yes, skin cancer may have come down a little bit, but all the other cancers went up because you're not getting vitamin D and sunlight. Right.
So a first thing in the morning walk without being super covered up, having your skin exposed, sounds like it would do the bright light and the vitamin D.
You have to be practical. If it's cold, you have to wear something. But the most important thing is to take that sunlight into your eyes to reset your circadian clock.
Yeah.
And then as much skin exposure as possible. And depending on how quickly you burn, an early morning is not that bad. But even during the day, it's important to get sunlight because around the middle of the day, that's when you get the vitamin D conversion the most. But also early morning and late afternoon, that's when you also get near-infrared radiation. The red lights, near-infrared. Now, I don't know if you've heard about this. This is just...
Shocking. So I have, but just because of my friend Molly Eastman, who's an influencer on Instagram, and she's always sending me all sorts of things. It's pretty interesting.
It is. And I apply it. I use the red light box every day.
Okay. What time are you doing the red light?
Well, I do it whenever because I can't depend on the sun all the time. Sunlight is the best way of getting near infrared, early morning and late afternoon.
Okay.
But I do it on a regular basis, but also after I injure myself during sports or have a sore knee or a muscle ache, I use the red light therapy. Hmm. And the theory behind it, the reason why it works is that the near infrared light activates the mitochondria to produce melatonin in all of your body. Acts as an anti-inflammatory antioxidant.
I need to get myself a red light.
It takes a while. If you use it on a regular basis, it takes a while to see the results, but I'm a true believer.
So how long do we have to wait for your new book?
I'm doing the book proposal right now for the publisher.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe.
So not too long. I mean,
I'm hoping to launch it in the fall.
Okay. Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you want to share with the audience?
Well, I think this is a topic that you keep bringing up on your podcast, and we mentioned a couple of times that yes, you have to work with your doctors, but ultimately you have to take total responsibility for your own health.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I had fun.
Thanks so much for listening. I love hearing from you. If you'd like to be featured in an upcoming episode of the podcast, please email me at sleepapneastories@gmail.com. That's also the place to get in touch if you just want to say hi or ask a question. Alternatively, I'm over on Instagram. My handle there is sleepapneastories. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe or follow, rate and review wherever you listen. This really helps a wider audience find the episodes, and I really appreciate it.